A gambler, a rock, a ring, and Kevin Garnett are the primary ingredients in Uncut Gems, a thriller directed by Josh and Benny Safdie. Adam Sandler stars as compulsive gambler Howard Ratner, and the film is so tense that calling it tense seems completely inadequate.
While Uncut Gems was shut out of the Oscars race, it's gotten other awards attention for Sandler and for the Safdies. And, like the film itself, the chatter around it has been plenty loud. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about Uncut Gems on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me and Stephen in the studio is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And in our fourth chair, we're delighted to welcome back the culture critic for The Undefeated, Soraya McDonald. Welcome back, Soraya.
Hello, hello. Oh, thanks for having me.
We're happy to be able to welcome you to such a calm discussion of such a calm film. If you have not read very much about this movie, essentially what happens in it is that Adam Sandler plays a jeweler who comes into possession of a large uncut gem, which he begins to kind of build his big score around the idea of selling this thing. And then Kevin Garnett shows up and wants to borrow it. And Howard finds himself drawn into an endless string of every time it seems like he's going to be able to pull himself out of trouble that he keeps getting into, he once again winds up back in trouble with his brother-in-law, played by Eric Bogosian, to whom he owes money. It's such a mess. It's such a mess, and he keeps making it worse.
Yep.
Glenn, what did you think of this movie?
It's a very frenzied performance and a very frenzied, jittery movie that is so full of nervous energy, you can almost miss how well-structured it is. People are constantly getting trapped in this movie, either, you know, physically or most often situationally, and it's what compulsion feels like. It's compulsion, the movie. It keeps building to something, ratcheting up the tension. And when you think about it, like when you're on your way home, it feels like this film had a ringing telephone in the background all the way through, or a crying baby, or a barking dog all the way through. It didn't go that far, but that's the sensation you come with. And it's not done physically. It's done through the camera work and Sandler's performance. Now, I know nothing about jewelry. I know nothing about gambling. I know nothing about basketball. I know little about the specific species of male mask peacocking that this film is kind of about. But I was with this movie all the way. He uses Altman's overlapping dialogue and that kind of like jittery, restless camera. So you get this impression that's very claustrophobic. While I admired its attempt to kind of contextualize these events by bracketing them at the beginning and end with a through line that kind of goes from the geological to the biological to the cosmic, that tiny part of the film, which is really just at the beginning and the end, felt writerly to me. I admired it, but I was so involved with the story that thematic stuff felt like Lily Gilding.
It's less immersive.
Less immersive. I was into this film.
Yeah. Soraya, tell me how you felt about Uncut Gems.
Oh, man, he's such a deeply frustrating character.
I think that's an understatement with which I strongly agree.
You're really sitting there and you're just like, your life does not have to be like this. Mm-hmm. Come on. He is addicted to making bad decisions. Mm-hmm. What Glenn was saying about this being compulsion, the movie, I think is just so spot on. I think the other thing that contributes to this sort of atmosphere of frenzy is the score.
Yeah.
That just, you know, will not ever let you rest along with the rest of this movie. I remember telling my editor when he was telling me he was going to see it, I was like, oh, well, you know, just take a beta blocker before you go.
Yeah. Where do you come down on Adam Sandler generally?
So I thought this was one of, like, the best performances of his career, to the point that I'm actually frustrated by some of the other just, like, mindless dreck that he's decided to do.
Yeah.
Why are you hiding this light under a bushel, Adam Sandler? Like, you are
whoever
clearly
knew
capable
that we would find ourselves saying that.
Of so much more. You know, and I say this as a person who still appreciates Bobby Boucher.
Sure. Sure.
But could have done without Grown Ups and Grown Ups too.
Yeah. And I think it's funny because for me, Adam Sandler has always been such a frustrating actor because when he's not doing the kind of manic comedy thing, he often does a kind of a hangdog thing. And then I kind of tune out from him. What I like about this performance is it's the manic comedy thing, except most of it isn't funny. It's a very on Adam Sandler, but in a very unfunny way. Like, if you imagine what Adam Sandler, as you see him in movies, would be like in real life if upset, that's what it feels like. Stephen, where did you come down on this one?
Well, I am a deeply anxious person. Mm-hmm. I often turn to entertainment that soothes me, that settles my nerves, that calms me down. That's usually the direction that I need to be pulled.
So it's perfect.
So this movie was perfect for me. I loved it, but I also would recommend getting yourself into the right mindset to see it if you are, like me, an anxious person, because it is just constantly ratcheting up the bad decisions. It's not just that it is full of a character's bad ideas. It is full of some of the loudest bad ideas that you will ever experience in a movie. The dialogue is extremely shouty. Soraya mentioned the music by 10 Tricks Point Never, which takes a little getting used to. This is a very gritty movie. It's not necessarily a movie in which you expect to hear like the Blade Runner score kind of overpowering the dialogue in some ways. It is constantly setting you akimbo. That's very much by design. It is enormously effective at it. You know how we sometimes talk on the show about heist movies we like, where like everything is this Swiss watch where everything has to go exactly a certain way in order for this incredibly elaborate plan to work. And this is like the exact opposite of that, where every decision has to be exactly wrong in a certain way. And that is fascinating to watch.
Yeah. But I put this in the context too of I talked a couple of times about films this year that have considered capitalism and money and extraordinary wealth, whether it's comedies like Knives Out or Parasite or the horror movie The Platform that Glenn talked about. Mm-hmm. There does seem to be a kind of a push forward this year in films that in some way, Hustlers too, get at the way that wealth works and the way that rich people and poor people do or do not interact with each other. And for me, this was also a film that was very much about Howard, this jeweler, cannot stop wanting a bigger and bigger and bigger payoff for getting a hold of this rock, which... You know, it's not an accomplishment. He's just gotten a hold of it, and he can't stop wanting to parlay it into, you know, endless wealth. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's not good enough to be a solid win. And there are so many situations in real life where you want to say to people, if you had been able, we talked about this with Theranos, if you had been able to look at this as a solid win instead of needing it to be endless wealth for generations, you would have been fine. Mm-hmm. And the issue with him in this is he can't settle for a solid win.
Right.
It's always, I want the next thing, which we always associate with compulsive gambling. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting to think of it in the context of all these other, like, why wasn't it good enough to be comfortable kinds of things.
Yeah, I think there are like two things that come to mind for me. The first one is that when it comes to this idea of settling and being happy with what you have, usually that is a message that's directed at women in romantic comedies. just about every single one. But in this case, you know, he already has so much. He has a business that, you know, is working. He has this wonderful wife. He has a family. He has a mistress. You know, he's got a pied-à-terre and a house.
Mm-hmm. He's got bejeweled Furbies.
He's got bejeweled Furbies, for Christ's sake. The other thing is that, so for some reason, there has been this spate of articles that I keep seeing from like Forbes and Money Magazine about this particular class of millennials who make six-figure incomes, but are classified as Henrys, which is high earners, not rich yet.
Oh, wow.
Who like make six figures but somehow still feel like they're broke, uh-huh. either because they live in really expensive cities. Essentially, they're living above their means, right? And then posting all of these things on Instagram, among other things. You know, when we're looking at class, particularly like when we're trying to parse out like how rich people or wealthy people don't feel like they're rich or wealthy because they're always comparing themselves mm-hmm. to the person who makes more money than they do rather than than the person who is making less money than they do. I mean, you just see this over and over again in Howard's life. He is the guy who provides the baubles
right.
for other richer people to show right. off how much money they have.
He's a procurer for musicians and athletes and other people who are into these very flashy, you know, Stephen mentioned the diamond Furby. There have been some really fun little articles about the fact that apparently that's a bespoke thing they made for the movie. There's not really a diamond encrusted,
So I can't aspire to obtain one.
But I did like the fact that they... It sounds like such a funny thing to say, but like I really liked the way they used Kevin Garnett in this movie.
Yes.
Because Kevin Garnett, you know, and this is set back a little bit in time, but Kevin Garnett was not Kobe Bryant, right? No. But he was a very famous basketball player, had a lot of money, but yet still has that thing of like, I feel like I need some advantage, you know, to like it, and is very, I very much liked the way they worked in the superstition of athletes and the fact that Garnett becomes very superstitious about this thing. I very much liked the way that Howard keeps running into, like, Howard has this run-in with The Weeknd.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that, like, man. The Weeknd in this movie is The Weeknd. And Kevin Garnett is Kevin Garnett. And I think you sort of, in order to play with those intersections between Howard and famous people, I mean, there is Lakeith Stanfield playing somebody who isn't Lakeith Stanfield.
Right.
But it can't just be, you know, you bring in an actor and say, we're going to tell you it's a famous person. We're going to tell you it's The Weeknd.
So they just have The Weeknd.
Has to actually be the weekend for it to work that way.
I'm really
as opposed to Entourage.
Exactly.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the weekend. There's a scene with The Weeknd that highlights part of what is so frustrating about Adam Sandler's character, which is his ability to, in key moments, think exactly zero moves ahead.
Yeah.
And so there's a scene like, I am surrounded by The Weeknd's bodyguards. So like, what if I punched one of them?
Yeah.
And there's just no planning at any point. And I also think with The Weeknd and with Kevin Garnett, this movie does a great job making nightlife, and especially nightlife involving famous people, seem like absolute hell on earth.
like a literal nightmare. There's a scene in that club where Howard goes up to Lakeith Stanfield, his kind of procurer, basically, Damani, and he's demanding something from him, and Lakeith Stanfield's character just keeps putting him off in a way that happens in dreams, in horrible dreams where you have something you desperately need, and people are like just kind of pushing you aside. The fact of the involvement of The Weeknd and Kevin Garnett is one of the things that makes this film feel so weirdly, I guess opportunistic is the right word, because the Safdie brothers' father worked in the Diamond District. Mm-hmm. And this film is kind of grew out of some of the, you know, the myths, the stories he would tell. That's why this film feels so authentic, lived in. It's one of the reasons that I think this film just feels as non-Oscar baity as a film could feel. I mean, if it did get nominated, if any aspect of this film got nominated, I would have been surprised, because this is not Hollywood. This is anti-Hollywood.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because as you were talking, I was thinking about the fact that, like, we've seen so many different versions of the sort of satirical look at Hollywood and the way people behave and sort of the ecosystem of rich and famous people that is very like Los Angeles specific. Mm-hmm. This film, because the Safdies are like so interested and invested in their work and sort of plumbing these different arenas of New York, you get that same sort of almost like social commentary about class, but it's in a very different context from the sort of like groveling and, you know, like who has what, like who has what agent, who has what deal, who has, you know, those sorts of things. It's a very New York specific story of this sort of fame and and class sort of ladder stepping.
He is not, like, he likes to kind of pal around with some of these guys, but he is not part of their circle in any way. And the minute that he, you know, if he begins to behave like he thinks he's friends with any of these, with The Weeknd or with Kevin Garnett or with Lakeith Stanfield's character, you know, he is not really part of these circles. He's just useful to them.
He gets shut down so fast.
Yeah.
And Idina Menzel isn't given much to do, but she projects a weariness with Howard's character.
Yeah, she plays his wife.
She's an audience surrogate that
way. She is an audience surrogate in a big way. She plays his estranged wife, and so much of that relationship is encapsulated right there in the in the first way she looks at him.
Yeah, you could just tell every time she sees him, she's like, oh. All right, well, if you get a chance to see Uncut Gems, let us know what you think. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment, What's Making Us Happy This Week. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Imperative Entertainment, presenting The Baron of Botox, a new podcast series from the team behind Broken Hearts. The Baron of Botox is about late dermatologist to the stars Frederick Brandt, who helped usher in the multi-billion dollar Botox industry. When Brandt killed himself in 2015, journalist and veteran magazine editor Justine Harmon began to obsess over one question: what is the price of beauty? Check out the trailer for The Baron of Botox and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support also comes from Behind the Scenes, The Witcher, the official companion podcast for the Netflix series The Witcher. So how did the writers, cast, and crew take almost 3,000 pages of original material and bring this world to light? In Behind the Scenes of The Witcher, host Brandon Jenkins finds out what it takes to adapt a fantasy book series into a season of television. New episodes premiere mid-January, with new episodes weekly. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
The Australian comedian Celeste Barber has been in the news in recent weeks. She's from Australia. Australia has been in the grips of these terrible, terrible bushfires that have caused so much damage and loss. She started a fundraising drive to raise $30,000 for members of her family who were affected by the fires. She has so far, and this number has been continuing to rise, raised the equivalent of about $35 million American dollars, which is obviously a lot more. Now she's facing how to even distribute that money properly. What is making me happy, in addition, obviously, to the enormous well of good faith and positive energy, is her Instagram feed, at Celeste Barber, which is an extraordinarily funny and silly and doofy, in which she recreates different modeling shoots the way a normal person would have to. So some of them are still photos where it's like a model in a swimsuit in some ridiculous pose and she tries to recreate it. Some of them are videos which get more elaborate. All of them are silly. All of them are just goofy and fun. I really highly recommend this Instagram feed at Celeste Barber.
Thank you so much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Avenue 5 premieres on HBO this Sunday. It's about a space cruise ship in the not-too-distant future on its maiden 8-week cruise around Saturn when something goes horribly awry. It's created by the team behind The Thick of It, so Armando Iannucci, who of course was the original showrunner for Veep, Simon Blackwell, and Tony Roach. Iannucci gets a story credit on every episode, but he only gets a teleplay credit, meaning he wrote dialogue for the pilot, which is also the only episode of the four that were released to the press that he directed himself. And what's fascinating to me is that it's the weakest of the four episodes that were made available to the press. But maybe it's not surprising because when you've got so much world building to do in that first episode and you have to introduce these characters, you can't get into their conflicts and flesh them out, which is what his whole thing is, just that the characters going up against each other. It does improve episode over episode as Hugh Laurie gets more to do. Basically, here's a rule of thumb. If a scene includes the characters of the hyper-competent assistant Iris, played by the great Susie Nakamura, or the semi-competent engineer Billy, who is played by Leonora Krishlow, it's going to be a lot of fun. If it includes the wildly rich but wildly incompetent man-boy played by Josh Gad, go figure, your attention might wane. The
point, I found him okay as long as he's mixed with other people.
Yeah, he needs to be mixed with other people. The point of the show, as far as it goes, is that humanity is fatuous and venal and grasping and quick to deflect blame, which is familiar Iannucci territory. But the setting is fun, and I suspect as the show goes along, it will allow relationships to deepen and complicate, because when you think of Veep, for example, you think of pairings of characters who may not like each other, but at least they have a grudging respect for each other, and that gives the show a level, a depth besides just caustic wit, which it needs. That's Avenue 5 on HBO on Sundays.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Soraya McDonald, what is making you happy this week?
So there are two women who are making me happy this week, and they are Katori Hall and Adrienne Warren. Katori is the playwright who wrote the book for the musical Tina, which tells the story of Tina Turner, and Adrienne Warren is the woman who plays her. I had the privilege of finally seeing Adrienne on stage this week, and she is just an absolute force in this musical. I will admit that I'm not necessarily a person who cares for jukebox musicals all that much. Usually the book isn't necessarily very well thought out, and Tina is a jukebox musical that really feels like more than that, and I think sort of goes beyond what we think of in terms of this genre, because it really does tell this very rich story of Tina's life, and it folds in the sort of like generational pressures that have influenced how she lives, and not just that, but also the generational factors and traumas that made Ike Turner the sort of villain that we know him as. But like on top of all of that, you have like this amazing, just fierce, energetic, charismatic force in Adrienne Warren, who really has just taken complete ownership of this role and puts her own spin on Tina Turner. She has sort of mastered that like smoky warbliness that we associate with Tina, but it doesn't feel like a cheap imitation. Like she has really sort of studied this woman's life and put her own interpretation on it, and it is just so magnetic.
All right. Thank you very much, Soraya McDonald. What is making me happy this week, you guys? The time has come. We have to talk about The Circle just a little. The Circle is a show on Netflix. There was a British version. They have now done the US version. It is a reality show, quote unquote. The hook is this. You take a group of people, I think it's eight at the beginning, and they're all sequestered in their own. It's like a one-bedroom apartment. They have a big video screen, and they only can communicate with each other through, quote unquote, social media, which really means, you know, a messaging system that they claim is like voice activated, but it's obviously just a PA in the back, like typing. So like they'll go up to the screen and say like, you know, message Jamie. And then like a little thing will pop up and they type back and forth. Now, the trick to it is supposed to be you can theoretically decide to be someone other than who you really are. So you could put up a profile picture that's all fake and, you know, you could pretend to be a man or a woman or a older or younger person or whoever you want. It is a really dumb show. It also...
Good. I was waiting for it.
It also comes across... It's one of those things where you look at it. There's one guy in particular. His name is Joey. You'll know him when you see him. He... You look at it and you think, is he doing a bit or not? Or frighteningly, has he been doing this bit for so long that it's no longer a bit? The show is so ridiculous and silly, and none of it feels genuine. Like I said, you just know that they're talking to this, like, send message. And that's not sending a message through the voice activity. They're just typing back and forth. Some other person is doing it.
Is there a point? Is it a competitive show?
Yes. So at the end of each episode, they vote somebody out.
Ah, okay.
And then at the end, you vote for who's most... The whole idea is, like, you know, who's most popular, who has the most likes, and it's all that supposed to be a social media thing, but it's really just vote people out. But it's like it's the equivalent of Survivor if they all lived in hotel rooms. That's kind of what it is. It's so dumb, but I watched the whole thing and I'm so embarrassed, but I would do it again. So The Circle is on Netflix. and you can find it there. And that is what is, believe it or not, making me somewhat happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can find Glenn at G.H. Weldon and Soraya at Soraya McDonald. You can find our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy and our producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band Hello Come In provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. And if you have a second and you're so inclined, subscribe to our newsletter. It's at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all right back here next week.
Yo, teachers and students! You want to ditch that boring book report and make a podcast instead?
NPR's Student Podcast Challenge is here with a new podcast to give you all the tips and tricks to making an amazing podcast of your own.
Listen and share with your friends.